Chapter 18. Certain chimney piece, and there are dozens of giants, titans warring with Jove, on the walls of another room, so inconceivably ugly and grotesque, that it is marvelous, how any man can have imagined such creatures. In the chamber in which they abound, these monsters, with swollen faces and cracked cheeks, and every kind of distortion of look and limb, are depicted as staggering under the weight of falling buildings, and being overwhelmed in the ruins, upheaving masses of rock, and burying themselves beneath, vainly striving to sustain the pillars of heavy roofs that topple down upon their heads, and, in a word, undergoing and doing every kind of mad and demoniacal destruction. The figures are immensely large, and exaggerated to the utmost pitch of uncouthness. The coloring is harsh and disagreeable, and the whole effect more like, I should imagine, a violent rush of blood to the head of the spectator, than any real picture set before him by the hand of an artist. This apoplectic performance was shown by a sickly-looking woman, whose appearance was referable, I dare say, to the bad air of the marshes, but it was difficult to help feeling as if she were too much haunted by the giants, and they were frightening her to death, all alone in that exhausted cistern of a palace, among the reeds and rushes, with the mists hovering about outside, and stalking round, and round it continually. Our walk through Mantua showed us, in almost every street, some suppressed church, now used for a warehouse, now for nothing at all as crazy and dismantled as they could be, short of tumbling down bodily. The marshy town was so intensely dull and flat, that the dirt upon it seemed not to have come there in the ordinary course, but to have settled and mantled on its surface, as on standing water. And yet there were some business dealings going on, and some profits realizing, for there were arcades full of Jews, where those extraordinary people were sitting outside their shops, contemplating their stores of stuffs, and woolens, and bright handkerchiefs, and trinkets, and looking, in all respects, as wary and businesslike as their brethren in Houndsditch, London. Having selected a vetturino from among the neighboring Christians, who agreed to carry us to Milan in 2 days and a half, and to start, next morning, as soon as the gates were opened, I returned to the Golden Lion, and dined luxuriously in my own room, in a narrow passage between two bedsteads. Confronted by a smoky fire, and backed up by a chest of drawers. At 6 o'clock next morning, we were jingling in the dark through the wet cold mist that enshrouded the town, and, before noon, the driver, a native of Mantua, and 60 years of age or thereabouts, began to ask the way to Milan. It lay through Pozzolo, formerly a little republic, and now one of the most deserted and poverty-stricken of towns, where the landlord of the miserable inn, God bless him, it was his weekly custom, was distributing infinitesimal coins among a clamorous herd of women and children, whose rags were fluttering in the wind and rain outside his door, where they were gathered to receive his charity. It lay through mist, and mud, and rain, and vines trained low upon the ground, all that day and the next. The first sleeping place being Cremona, memorable for its dark brick churches, and immensely high tower, the terrazzo to say nothing of its violins, of which it certainly produces none in these degenerate days, and the second, Lodi. Then we went on, through more mud, mist, and rain, and marshy ground, and through such a fog, as Englishmen, strong in the faith of their own grievances, are apt to believe, is nowhere to be found, but in their own country, until we entered the paved streets of Milan. The fog was so dense here, that the spire of the far-famed cathedral might as well have been at Bombay, for anything that could be seen of it at that time. But as we halted to refresh, for a few days then, and returned to Milan again next summer, I had ample opportunities of seeing the glorious structure in all its majesty and beauty. All Christian homage to the saint who lies within it. There are many good and true saints in the calendar, But San Carlo Borromeo as, if I may quote Mrs. Primrose on such a subject, my warm heart. Apostrophe a charitable doctor to the sick, a munificent friend to the poor, and this, not in any spirit of blind bigotry, but as the bold opponent of enormous abuses in the Romish Church, I honor his memory. I honor it nonetheless, because he was nearly slain by a priest, suborned, by priests, to murder him at the altar. In acknowledgement of his endeavors to reform a false and hypocritical brotherhood of monks, heaven shield all imitators of San Carlo Borromeo as it shielded him. A reforming pope would need a little shielding, even now. The subterranean chapel in which the body of San Carlo Borromeo is preserved presents as striking, and as ghastly a contrast, perhaps, as any place can show. The tapers which are lighted down there, flash and gleam on altar levy in gold and silver, delicately wrought by skillful hands, and representing the principal events in the life of the saint. Jewels, and precious metals, shine and sparkle on every side. A windlass slowly removes the front of the altar, and, within it, in a gorgeous shrine of gold and silver, is seen, through alabaster, the shriveled mummy of a man. The pontifical robes with which it is adorned, radiant with diamonds, emeralds, rubies, every costly and magnificent gem. The shrunken heap of poor earth in the midst of this great glitter is more pitiful than if it lay upon a dunghill. There is not a ray of imprisoned light in all the flesh and fire of jewels, but seems to mock the moldy holes where eyes were, once. Every thread of silk in the rich vestments seems only a provision from the worms that spin, for the behoof of worms, that propagate in sepulchres. In the old refectory of the dilapidated convent of Santa Maria del Grazi, is the work of art, perhaps, better known than any other in the world. The Last Supper, by Leonardo da Vinci with a door cut through it by the intelligent Dominican friars, to facilitate their operations at dinner time. I am not mechanically acquainted with the art of painting, and have no other means of judging of a picture than as I see it resembling and refining upon nature, and presenting graceful combinations of forms and colors. I am, therefore, no authority whatever, in reference to the touch of this or that master, though I know very well, as anybody may, who chooses to think about the matter, that few very great masters can possibly have painted, in the compass of their lives, one half of the pictures that bear their names, and that are recognized by many aspirants to a reputation for taste, as undoubted originals. But this, by the way, of the Last Supper, I would simply observe, that in its beautiful composition and arrangement, there it is, at Milan, a wonderful picture, and that, in its original coloring, or in its original expression of any single face or feature, there it is not. Apart from the damage it has sustained from damp, decay, or neglect, it has been, as Barry shows, so retouched upon, and repainted, and that so clumsily, that many of the heads are, now, positive deformities, with patches of paint and plaster sticking upon them like wens, and utterly distorting the expression. Where the original artist set that impress of his genius on a face, which, almost in a liner touch, separated him from meaner painters, and made him what he was, succeeding bunglers, filling up, or painting across seams and cracks, have been quite unable to imitate his hand, and putting in some scowls, or frowns, or wrinkles, of their own, have blotched and spoiled the work. This is so well established as an historical fact, that I should not repeat it, at the risk of being tedious, but for having observed an English gentleman before the picture, who was at great pains, to fall into, what I may describe as mild convulsions, at certain minute details of expression which are not left in it. Whereas, it would be comfortable and rational for travelers and critics, to arrive at a general understanding, that it cannot fail to have been a work of extraordinary merit, once, When, with so few of its original beauties remaining, the grandeur of the general design is yet sufficient to sustain it as a piece replete with interest and dignity. We achieved the other sights of Milan, in due course, and a fine city it is, though not so unmistakably Italian, as to possess the characteristic qualities of many towns far less important in themselves. The Corso, where the Milanese gentry ride up and down in carriages, and rather than not do which, they would half starve themselves at home, is a most noble public promenade, shaded by long avenues of trees. In the splendid theater of La Scala, there was a ballet of action performed after the opera, under the title of Prometheus. In the beginning of which, some hundred or two of men and women represented our mortal race before the refinements of the arts and sciences, and loves and graces, came on earth to soften them. I never saw anything more effective. Generally speaking, the pantomimic action of the Italians is more remarkable for its sudden and impetuous character than for its delicate expression, but, in this case, the drooping monotony, the weary, miserable, listless, moping life, the sordid passions and desires of human creatures, destitute of those elevating influences to which we owe so much, and to whose promoters we render so little, were expressed in a manner really powerful and affecting. I should have thought it almost impossible to present such an idea so strongly on the stage, without the aid of speech. Milan soon lay behind us, at 5 o'clock in the morning, and before the golden statue on the summit of the cathedral spire was lost in the blue sky, the Alps, stupendously confused in lofty peaks and ridges, clouds and snow, were towering in our path. Still, we continued to advance toward them until nightfall, and, all day long, the mountaintops presented strangely shifting shapes, as the road displayed them in different points of view. The beautiful day was just declining, when we came upon the Lago Maggiore, with its lovely islands. For however fanciful and fantastic the Isola Bella may be, and is, it still is beautiful. Anything springing out of that blue water, with that scenery around it, must be. It was 10 o'clock at night, when we got to Domo di Sola, at the foot of the pass of the Simplon. But as the moon was shining brightly, and there was not a cloud in the starlit sky, it was no time for going to bed, or going anywhere but on. So, we got a little carriage, after some delay, and began thus and. It was late in November, and the snow lying 4 or 5 feet thick in the beaten road on the summit. In other parts the new drift was already deep, the air was piercing cold. But, the serenity of the night, and the grandeur of the road, with its impenetrable shadows, and deep glooms, and its sudden turns into the shining of the moon, and its incessant roar of falling water, rendered the journey more and more sublime at every step. Soon leaving the calm Italian villages below us, sleeping in the moonlight, the road began to wind among dark trees, and after a time emerged upon a barer region, very steep and toilsome, where the moon shone bright and high. By degrees, the roar of water grew louder, and the stupendous track, after crossing the torrent by a bridge, struck in between two massive perpendicular walls of rock that quite shut out the moonlight, and only left a few stars shining in the narrow strip of sky above. Then, even this was lost, in the thick darkness of a cavern in the rock, through which the way was pierced, the terrible cataract thundering and roaring close below it, and its foam and spray hanging, in a mist, about the entrance. Emerging from this cave, and coming again into the moonlight, and across a dizzy bridge, it crept and twisted upward, through the gorge of Gondo, savage and grand beyond description, with smooth-fronted precipices, rising up on either hand, and almost meeting overhead. Thus we went, climbing on our rugged way, higher and higher all night, without a moment's weariness. Lost in the contemplation of the black rocks, the tremendous heights and depths, the fields of smooth snow lying in the clefts and hollows, and the fierce torrents thundering headlong down the deep abyss. Towards daybreak, we came among the snow, where a keen wind was blowing fiercely. Having, with some trouble, awakened the inmates of a wooden house in this solitude, round which the wind was howling dismally, catching up the snow in wreaths and hurling it away, we got some breakfast in a room built of rough timbers, but well warmed by a stove, and well contrived, as it had need to be, for keeping out the bitter storms. A sledge being then made ready, and four horses harnessed to it, we went, plowing, through the snow, still upward, but now in the cold light of morning, and with the great white desert on which we traveled, plain and clear. We were well upon the summit of the mountain, and had before us the rude cross of wood, denoting its greatest altitude above the sea, when the light of the rising sun struck, all at once, upon the waste of snow, and turned it a deep red. The lonely grandeur of the scene was then at its height. As we went sledging on, there came out of the hospice founded by Napoleon, a group of peasant travelers, with staves and knapsacks, who had rested there last night. Attended by a monk or two, their hospitable entertainers, trudging slowly forward with them, for company's sake. It was pleasant to give them good morning, and pretty, looking back a long way after them, to see them looking back at us, and hesitating presently, when one of our horses stumbled and fell, whether or no they should return and help us. But he was soon up again, with the assistance of a rough wagoner whose team had stuck fast thereto, and when we had helped him out of his difficulty, in return, we left him slowly plowing towards them, and went slowly and swiftly forward, on the brink of a steep precipice, among the mountain pines. Taking to our wheels again, soon afterwards, we began rapidly to descend, passing under everlasting glaciers, by means of arched galleries, hung with clusters of dripping icicles, under and over foaming waterfalls, near places of refuge, and galleries of shelter against sudden danger, through caverns over whose arched roofs the avalanches slide, in spring, and bury themselves in the unknown gulf beneath. Down, over lofty bridges, and through horrible ravines, a little shifting speck in the vast desolation of ice and snow, and monstrous granite rocks, down through the deep gorge of the Sultan, and deafened by the torrent plunging madly down, among the riven blocks of rock, into the level country, far below. Gradually down, by zigzag roads, lying between an upward, and a downward precipice, into warmer weather, calmer air, and softer scenery, until there lay before us, glittering like gold or silver in the thaw and sunshine, the metal-covered, red, green, yellow, domes and church spires of a Swiss town. The business of these recollections being with Italy, and my business, consequently, being to scamper back thither as fast as possible, I will not recall, though I am sorely tempted, how the Swiss villages, clustered at the feet of giant mountains, looked like playthings, or how confusedly the houses were heaped and piled together, or how there were very narrow streets to shut the howling winds out in the winter time, and broken bridges, which the impetuous torrents, suddenly released in spring, had swept away, or how there were peasant women here, with great round fur caps, looking, when they peeped out of casements, and only their heads were seen, like a population of sword-bearers to the Lord Mayor of London, or how the town of Vevey, lying on the smooth lake of Geneva, was beautiful to see, or how the statue of St. Peter in the street at Freiburg grasps the largest key that ever was beheld, or how Freiburg is illustrious for its two suspension bridges and its grand cathedral organ, or how, between that town and Bale, the road meandered among thriving villages of wooden cottages, with overhanging thatched roofs, and low protruding windows, glazed with small round panes of glass-like crown pieces, or how, in every little Swiss homestead, with its carter wagon carefully stowed away beside the house, its little garden, stock of poultry, and groups of red-cheeked children, there was an air of comfort, very new and very pleasant after Italy, or how the dresses of the women changed again, and there were no more sword-bearers to be seen, and fair white stomachers, and great black, fan-shaped, gauzy-looking caps, prevailed instead. Or how the country by the Jura Mountains, sprinkled with snow, and lighted by the moon, and musical with falling water, was delightful. Or how, below the windows of the great hotel of the Three Kings at Bale, the swollen Rhine ran fast and green. Or how, at Strasbourg, it was quite as fast, but not as green, and was said to be foggy lower down, and, at that late time of the year, was a far less certain means of progress than the highway road to Paris. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.